Hello and welcome to the Permaculture Podcast with Scott Mann. In this episode, my guest is Kelly Hogan, head of the Mother Earth School in Portland, Oregon. Before we get into the introduction, if you like this or any other episode of the Permaculture Podcast with Scott Mann, I want to ask you to take 2 minutes and do two things for me. First, share the show with your circles by posting a link on Facebook, Twitter, your blog, or any other place around the web that you frequent. Also, leave a review on your favorite podcast site. Everyone who finds and listens to the show helps to make permaculture a more common and accepted idea. Kelly Hogan is our guest for this episode because I was looking for someone to share a different perspective on how to teach children permaculture. As a parent of 2 small children, I'm continually revising my own methods and find that seeking the experience and wisdom of another adds to the available options and can provide clarity on how to succeed quickly. Kelly, by explaining her personal place as a teacher, shares with us how she operates the Mother Earth School program, guiding children throughout the year in an outdoor environment. During that time, we discuss the importance of storytelling, when she also shares a rough draft of a story she's working on. And we wrap up the episode by discussing the Advanced Permaculture Teacher Training in Teaching Children and Youth Permaculture. Yeah, I know it's quite a mouthful, but that's a program that she teaches alongside her partner Matt Bebo and Patty Parks Wasserman. During our conversation, I kept thinking of Richard Loeb and his book Last Child in the Woods and the idea of nature deficit disorder and the need to be teaching children in the outdoors. That led to some further research on my part while editing this show, and you'll find some additional information on these ideas in the show notes. I bring them up because these ideas of a forest kindergarten, a forest school, or an outdoor school are some models that are being practiced that are similar to Kelly's that can give you an idea of how to get started with an outdoor children's permaculture school. And if you or someone you know are interested in starting a school like that to bring these dynamic outdoor experiences to children, Kelly is willing to help you by answering questions or pointing you in the right direction. You can find her contact information and a link to the Mother Earth School at thepermaculturepodcast.com. I hope you enjoy this time with Kelly Hogan as much as I did. On with the interview. Kelly, why don't you give us a little bit of your background in teaching and permaculture and working with children, and we'll take the interview from there.
Okay, great. Thanks. I began being really interested in teaching when my son was born. Well, probably after he was a couple years old when I was looking for schools for him, which was a little over 10 years ago. And he started going to a little Waldorf preschool, and I got really curious as to what was going on with Waldorf education because it felt really strong, and it felt really, in a really good way. I felt like I was at home when I was in his classroom. And so I went into a Waldorf teacher training program and soon decided that instead of actually teaching at a Waldorf school, I was interested in working from my own impulses, which included other things that I was interested in, one of them being permaculture. And so I got my permaculture design certificate 3 or 4 years ago and realized that permaculture and Waldorf education are kind of speaking, well, not even kind of speaking, are really speaking to the same impulses, just using slightly different languaging. And so I was really excited when I noticed that because it's really beautiful to work through different lenses and sort of end up at the same place. And it really all comes down to nature and nature as teacher. So I also transitioned to working for an all-outdoor kindergarten, which happened to be held at, like, the site where the kindergarten was at the urban farm where I was living in an intentional community. And so all of these things converged at once, and I began running the school a few months later, the next year, and sort of changed from being a Waldorf school to being a Waldorf-inspired school that weaves in permaculture and primitive skills work in an all-outdoor nature immersion setting on an urban permaculture farm in Portland. And Portland is such an amazing city. We also have a huge forest, a 700-acre forest behind us. And so we're really homesteading and doing wilderness skills and permaculture all in one amazing experience with little children.
And because of how your site has all of that stuff available, you can just bring the children directly to you and they can experience the farm, the forest, the urban setting, permaculture, plus a early childhood education all in one location?
Yeah, it's pretty amazing because Try and Life Community Farm is the name of the nonprofit where the intentional community is. It's an education demonstration center, and the intentional community is a demonstration of sustainable living. And so, as well as all of the natural buildings, we have a Cobb sauna, which for the school children we call the Dragon's Lair. And in the really, really cold months of the year, we will light a little fire in there in the morning. And of course, since it's thermal mass, it holds the heat all day long. Eventually, when, you know, the children have been outside for about 4 hours right before they go home, we'll go into the Cobb sauna, the Dragon's Lair, and we'll tell a little story to them. So it's a great way for them to dry off and warm up a little bit before they go home. And we also have a huge outdoor kitchen, really, really beautiful, built with round wood and cedar shingles. And we have a rocket stove and a Cobb oven and a thermal mass rocket heater, which is a dragon bench. And the bench gets warm when the rocket stove is warm. So we cook over fire every day for our snack. And a couple days of the week, we have grains that we cook on the rocket stove. And then one day a week, we have bread that we cook in the Cobb oven. So that's all already on site, as well as about a half acre in production of permaculture gardens. Maybe a half acre to an acre in production. There's a huge greenhouse, an orchard, food forest, and then a 700-acre second growth forest, Pacific Northwest forest, that surrounds the 7-acre farm. We have a barn. We have goat. We had sheep on site until this past year, so all of the wool work that we did after we sheared the sheep. And we have chickens and bees, beehives. So that's all on site, and so the children come and can participate. You know, our curriculum emerges as the seasons unfold, and so we're homesteading and gardening and doing the work of living in a land-based setting with the children as their education.
When you have the children in that environment and you're teaching to them, are you doing a lot of experiential learning then, a lot of hands-on work? How are you blending that together?
It's primarily experiential. So we're teaching preschool and kindergarten at that site. Next year, we'll be starting a first and second grade at another urban farm in southeast Portland. That will weave in academics and more of kind of getting a little bit more into the intellectual side of things. Of course, just gradually and artistically is how we're going to be introducing academics to our grade school children. For the preschool and kindergarten, we're doing everything experientially. And so I've been speaking to permaculture education for children as embodied permaculture, where we're using the principles and, well, the ethics that are at the foundation of everything that we're doing. And our entire curriculum really focuses on care for the earth and care for each other. And, of course, sharing is at the heart of any early childhood curriculum. And so that's easy. That's just inherent in what we're doing out there. And then the principles come in many different ways, usually not explicitly through explanation, but really just implicitly through everything that we're doing. So that comes down, you know, it comes in through the stories that we tell, it comes in through how we manage our classroom, as well as sort of the content of what the children are learning.
You say that you're not doing it necessarily explicitly through definition, but rather through demonstration. Do you find that involving the children that way, that they're getting it without needing to talk about it?
Absolutely. I think that basically what we sort of joke and we say that if we're teaching permaculture education to children experientially, then eventually when these children become adults, we wouldn't have a need for adult permaculture classes. You know, we sort of joke that we're putting adult permaculture courses out of business, right? If we were really, really, if every educational system was really modeling a balanced system, then children are going to grow up with that being their baseline experience and almost an expectation. And so they recognize very quickly when things are out of balance. And we can witness that even just, you know, from the few years that we spend with children. It's really clear to them if something's going on that doesn't seem quite right, you know. And so they get a chance to compare what they know outside of their experience at school and being at the farm to what their experience is at the farm. And it's sort of a little, it's really a magical little world that we're creating with them there. It rests so deeply in their being that years later when they come back after they've gone off to public school or homeschool or Waldorf school or wherever it is that they are headed in the world, when they come back for our summer camps and things like that, the recognition and the sense of place and the sense of connection to place and their awareness of their own power and their own capabilities to heal and to understand the world around them just light up again. And it's really a beautiful thing to witness. And we've been teaching, our school has been running, we're enrolling for our sixth year now. And so we do have children that, you know, 5 years ago were in our kindergarten. And when they come back to visit, or when we go out and teach garden classes and things like that at their schools, there's really a really special spark that we see in these children that I feel like is the recognition of permaculture as a practice. Yeah, I know that they're getting that really strongly without having it explained to them.
I know with my own children that a lot of our experiences together as we work through things, I don't have to talk about why we're composting. I just do that and they get to see that and work through the process with me, because then it becomes one that any food scraps don't go into a garbage can, they go into the compost bin. Then that goes outside or something goes to the worms. That kind of an experience, just as a parent, I see, but to see it in an educational setting is a much bigger picture that I haven't gotten to experience. So hearing that from someone who's doing that kind of work is reassuring to me and what I'm doing.
Definitely, because we're creating habits in children. You know, we're really helping to guide them, especially in their really early years. They're meeting the physical world for the first time, you know, and they're learning all about it. And so as they develop, as soon as they're, you know, walking and talking and interacting and becoming social beings, to really just have them getting into the habit of bringing the compost to the chickens and witnessing being able to feed and care for animals and mucking out the hen house and bringing the resources from the chickens over to compost piles that then go on the garden and pulling food out of the garden. It makes total sense to them because it's real and it's the system as it's meant to be. And so it's really familiar to young children because they're coming from the spiritual world. It's this big mystery to us. And everything that's on earth is really, you know, patterned by these same forces where they were just handfuls of years before. And so when they come in and they're just really working with healthy natural systems, it just makes sense to them. It's where they're in their element. And even children, you know, there's definitely been, our modern culture has a lot of influence on children, and there's some children that don't know the outdoors and it's uncomfortable to them at first. And so I really think that working with the Waldorf philosophy is a really beautiful way to really be able to see who these children are, what their needs are, recognize that our responsibility is to not just impart information on them, but is to learn who they are as beings and to love who they are as beings and to create an emergent curriculum based on the children that are with us and what their needs are, so that we can be looking at their thresholds of tolerance to weather and cold and, you know, physical activity and things like that. You know, where is their balance? How is their proprioceptive system and all of their neurological and sensory development? And then we can really introduce experiences gently to them. And, you know, as long as we're working with this edge between, you know, the child and the culture that they're growing up with and nature and the wild and the natural world, and we do that gently, it's, of course, you know, as we know as permaculturists, it's the most productive place. And so at our most recent permaculture education for children teacher training course, we were talking about the principles and asking our course participants to let us know, you know, which principle seems to make a lot of sense applied to education and which ones weren't they so clear about. And it was fascinating because the edge effect, to use the edges and value the marginal, came up a lot as the one where people weren't quite clear how it applied to education. And as I was thinking about it and as we were talking about it, I went over to the board and on our whiteboard, I changed the word education to edge-ucation, because I realized what emerged from our conversation was that any learning is an edge because you haven't been there before. And so that's inherently what we're doing. And with young children, especially young children that are influenced by modern culture, technology, media, we need to be really keenly aware and respectful of their edges. And then we need to use gentle enhancement through, you know, being immersed in nature, but keeping them warm and keeping them occupied and busy and feeling safe. And, you know, then all of the awareness builds as the year goes on. And by the time they're at the end of the school year, you know, they know so many of the plants in the forest around them. They know what they can eat. They know what will sting them. They know how to work with the plants, like the nettles that would otherwise sting them, in order to not get stung, and how to make rope out of nettles. And they're learning which herbs heal their cold. And so we'll make teas with those herbs if a child comes with, you know, a cold or something like that. And so they're actively working through nature and creating an emergent curriculum just based on life and experience and their needs.
The children seem to be having a great time with all this. How do their parents react and interact with your program? I imagine being a private program, the families who are becoming involved are doing it because they're interested in what you have to offer. But as their children get enrolled and go through the course year, what kind of feedback are you getting from parents about the program?
They love it. They ask if they can stay. I mean, really, it's sort of the most commonly asked question. Can I stay too? Or, you know, I really don't know this yet, and I would love to learn this. And, it's amazing because the children end up teaching their parents so much. The parents will come and, you know, they'll say, oh, I heard you went into the forest to see baby owls. You know, I'd really love to go in and see it. Can you tell me where it is? And I'll just say, well, your child will take you. You know, they know how to get there. They know exactly where it is. And it's so fascinating watching the parents' edges sort of be pushed as well. Like, really, I'm going to let my 3-year-old guide me into the forest somewhere, you know? And they'll always come and say, Miss Kelly, is it okay for us to eat licorice root? You know? Well, yeah, sure. Especially if your child told you so, because they probably know, because, you know, they're doing it and it's okay. And they can recognize all the different ferns in the forest and they know what they can eat. And so I would say that for the most part, before school starts, parents are always concerned that their children are going to be cold. And that's our top priority, is that the children are safe and warm. And so we have, you know, very clear guidelines around what the children come to school dressed in, so that they're dressed for the weather. And we have all sorts of little ways to help and keep them warm. And then as the school year goes on, it's really magical to watch the experience of the parents and how much they learn from their children's process and witnessing that. And so much of the way that we teach children, because we're using the Waldorf philosophy, so are passionate about place-based learning, we do storytelling and songs and experience. And so the children learn so much about what's happening around them, not because they're being told this is a bracken fern, but because they'll hear a story about Brother Bracken and how he helps the stings of Sister Nettle. And, you know, just, you know, they sort of float through the experience of the year that's happening around them through these stories. They're naming what's about to happen or what is currently happening through characters. And then these characters will also embody different impulses or issues or concerns that are going on socially with the group or maybe individually with a child. And so, you know, that curative aspect of storytelling as well gets brought in with all of the academic curriculum that is, you know, like I said before, not explicitly taught academically, but is really brought through this sort of visual, experiential, story, song, imagination sort of learning.
With the storytelling and songs that you're doing, are there any resources that you used in order to develop your abilities and skills as a storyteller, or are there any published or available song books or storytelling books that you pull material from?
So a lot of what I've learned from teaching outside is that when I've tried to refer to other people's work, it never exactly fits because it's not exactly where I am. And so what I do is I have a book called, one of the authors is Pojar. It's called Plants of the Pacific Northwest Coast, I think. There's a lot of ethnobotany in there. And so when you look up different plants, it says how the native people used it, whether it was used medicinally or for crafts or food. So I just really try to find out what type of relationship people had with the plants and the animals of the area. And then I try to listen to storytellers as much as possible. And I've asked some Native American elders and mentors and storytellers how they feel about their stories being retold by people who aren't native to this area. What I have gotten from that is that it's not my place to retell a story that is from a culture that's not mine. But what I've learned is by hearing the content of different stories from different cultures around the world, really, and noticing that you know, they're speaking to a certain place, and they're usually speaking to different issues and lessons, sort of life lessons, then I can really look at my group and through my Waldorf training really understand the needs that I'm seeing emerge from the group. And then from my knowledge of the place where I'm teaching, I can make up the stories. And so it's an edge for me, actually, to storytelling. And I know a lot of people feel that way. They think, well, I'm not a storyteller, so I couldn't do that. But it's really about practicing. And young children are such a wonderful audience, because they just love stories. And when you see how much they love it, and when you're really connecting with nature in order to sort of receive the wisdom and the inspiration to tell a story, it really starts to flow. And so I would say that, you know, my training in Waldorf education has introduced me to so many beautiful songs and nature-based circles and stories and, you know, verses and things like that. And I do reference some Waldorf-inspired books about circles and songs, but I always change them in order to make them exactly fit what's happening for me and my children and my place.
So because you have an emergent curriculum, you're building the material as you go and changing that depending on the needs of each group of children as they come through your program every year and build and grow that?
Yes. And so even my own stories are never the same as they were the year before. You know, some of them I might never tell again after I tell it once, although I do tell it for a few weeks at a time. So we have sort of 3-week blocks of story, sort of thematic craft and circle. And then that sort of changes. So I have about 13 3-week blocks in a school year that I do.
Not to put you on the spot too much, but do you have a particular story that you use over and over again that you'd like to share?
Well,
you can say no, that's okay.
It makes me so nervous when all of a sudden I have to tell them. So I am working on a story right now based on a training that I just did up at the Wilderness Awareness School, which was started by John Young and many other amazing people, mentors of his and other people passionate about connection with nature. And I went up there to do a training called The Art of Mentoring, because as a Waldorf teacher, we recognize that what we're doing is an art and not teaching is an art. It's not a job, or, you know, it's not a prescription. You're not telling children information. If you actually want it to be retained, you really want to help to guide them to be inspired to learn. And so I went up and did this training, and they were talking about the core routines that they use in order to sort of give children a foundation of their connection with nature. And they have to do with sense meditations and sit spots and fox walking through the forest really quietly, and owl eyes, you know, using your wide lens vision. And so what I'm working on right now is a story that sort of weaves these concepts in, as well as weaving our activity. We were dyeing silks with plant dye. So I could tell it. I just made it up a couple days ago, and I'm still sort of working on it. But if you want me to tell it, I will.
If you feel comfortable enough sharing, I'd love to hear it.
Okay. Can you give me just 1 second to sort of clear?
Go ahead.
And take a big breath. Okay. There is a really beautiful forest that surrounds an enchanted garden. And every year in high summer, when the sun is shining warmly in the sky and shines every day, there's a great celebration that happens with all of the creatures of the forest. Now, the celebration happens because everyone in the forest is so grateful for all of the food that is growing in the enchanted garden. For if you were a bird sitting on one of the tall trees that overlooks the garden, you would see that it looks as if a rainbow had touched down on the ground. For there are tomatoes that are beginning to turn red, and there are calendula flowers that are orange, and yellow squash, and green beans, blueberries, purple eggplant. And there's a little girl that lives near the forest and the farm, and the creatures in the forest consider her their friend because she's never hurt a plant or an animal, and she plays outside every single day. And since she plays outside every single day, this little girl has learned that she doesn't just listen with her ears and see with her eyes, but she also listens and sees with her heart. And so when the wind blows by, she doesn't just hear the breeze, she can actually hear the breeze whispering messages to her. And so this day, the breeze blew past her ear and said to her, "You are invited to a magical celebration that is happening this evening when the sun sets. If you can come, be sure to wear clothes that are as fine as the wings of a butterfly." Well, the little girl was very excited to hear that she was invited to a celebration, but she did not know if she had clothes that were as fine as the wings of a butterfly. And so she went inside to ask her mother, who was cooking breakfast. "Mother," she said, "I was invited to a magical celebration in the forest today, and I was asked to wear clothes that are as fine as the wings of a butterfly. I have lots of colorful clothes, but I don't know that any of them are that fine. Do you know where I might find such a thing?" And the mother looked at her daughter and smiled. "The forest will always provide you with exactly what you need," she said. And when the mother said this, the girl knew this to be true. And so after breakfast, she walked into the forest. She did not know quite where to go, but as she entered the woods, an owl was sitting on a tree and said to her, "Hoo, hoo, hoo, remember to use your owl eyes." And so the girl remembered that if she looked straight ahead of her, but she didn't look at anything in particular, she could open her eyes so that they could see all the way out to the side. And as she walked through the forest with her owl eyes really wide open, all of a sudden, she saw the flick of a robin's tail in the corner of her eyes. And when she looked over at the robin was not singing a song as if she was happy and comfortable. She was making a sound that suggested that she might be a little agitated. Perhaps she could see from the branch she was perched on that a creature was walking along the forest floor. And so the little girl stepped back into the bushes so that she could not be seen very easily at all. And sure enough, a moment later, Fox came walking by. Now Fox looked over, for he knew that the girl was there. It's hard to sneak around when a fox is around. And Fox doesn't say much, but Fox looked at the girl, looked down at his feet, looked back at the girl again, and walked carefully away. And the little girl knew that the fox was reminding her to look at how he walked so carefully in the forest. He set down his toes so gently, and you couldn't hear a sound as he walked. In fact, she would have never known that he was coming at all if it weren't for the bird who was telling the other creatures in the forest from the branch that she was perched on. And so the little girl continued on her walk. And she set down her toes gently before she put the rest of her feet down so that she would know if there was a branch underneath of her or a leaf that might crunch and make any sound. And silently she walked, fox walk, down to the creek. And when she got to the creek, she arrived so quietly that deer hadn't even heard her coming. But when deer saw her there, deer walked past and said, "Remember to use your deer ears." And so the little girl listened carefully with her ears, and the first thing she could hear was the water babbling in the brook, falling down the stones, and making a beautiful, joyful sound. But when she listened even more carefully, she could hear behind the babbling brook that there was another little splashing sound. And so she walked very quietly toward the sound, and when she reached that part of the bank, there was a tiny, tiny little man sitting there with a beard down to his toes and a pointy little cap. He was very busy, for in front of them he had little stone bowls that he had carved, and inside of each bowl he put some water, and inside of the water he sprinkled magical potion made out of bark and roots and flowers and berries. And then inside each of the pots he put in the finest silk that the little girl had ever seen. It was beautiful white silk when it went into the pot, and she knew it could only be a gift from Sister Silkworm. She watched so quietly as the little gnome placed the silks in each of the pots, and then he waited so patiently for quite a while, listening to the singing of the brook. And then, after a little while of waiting patiently, he pulled the silks out of the pot, and each silk that came out was a brilliant color of the rainbow. he hung the silks on branches that were hanging over the creek to blow in the wind to dry. And then he scrubbed out the pots, stacked them neatly, looked in the direction of the little girl as if he had known that she had been there the whole time, winked, smiled, and disappeared. Well, the little girl had a feeling in her heart when he winked and smiled at her that she was allowed to take one of those scarves as if it was a gift that he was making just for her. But she decided to listen carefully to the breeze as it blew past her ears just to make sure she wasn't taking something that didn't belong to her. And in fact, the breeze, the very same breeze that was drying these beautiful silks, whispered past her, "You are more than welcome to take one of these, and why don't you take some for the friends that helped you get here as well?" And so the little girl picked her favorite color, and then she took the others off of the branches, leaving one behind just in case the little gnome would like to attend the celebration himself with a garment that was as fine as the butterfly wings. And on her walk back, she passed by deer and gave deer a silk, and she passed by fox and gave fox a silk, and she passed by robin and gave robin a silk, and she passed by owl and gave owl a silk. And that night, as the sun was setting, she dressed herself in her beautiful, fine silk. It was as fine as butterfly wings. And into the forest she went for the great celebration of gratitude for the abundance of the rainbow foods in the garden. And she saw all of the forest creatures there, except for one, the little gnome. But since the girl was so good at listening with her heart and seeing with her heart, even though she didn't hear him or see him with her eyes or ears, she knew that he was there somewhere, full of gratitude, just like the girl and the rest of the creatures of the forest. So that's a rough version of the story, an on-the-spot version.
Well, for being on the spot, you did a beautiful job. Thank you very much for sharing that with us.
You're welcome. Thanks for asking me to. It's actually really good practice for me to push that edge. So did you hear all the curriculum pieces inside of it, embedded in it?
Yes. Okay. Yes, I did. That all came together. Okay.
Good.
Very nicely.
Good, good. Yeah, all those little lessons about just really having heightened awareness and really sort of trusting your instincts and knowing that there's, you know, something deeper happening around us than what we can see and hear. And I feel like for really little children, that's a really important thing to acknowledge for them, because we have a world that's very three-dimensional for them to be in. And there's just, you know, like these children are really, I feel like one of the things that my mom taught me when I was little that I appreciated so much was she always taught me that if I ever had a bad feeling about something, to trust it, you know? And so what she was really getting at is you have intuition, you have instinct, you have, like, there's more than just what makes logical sense on the surface. And I feel like nature as teacher is a really beautiful way to understand the world in a non-linear fashion, because it's all cycles and it's all cyclical. And so it's a really beautiful way to just really acknowledge and honor intuition and awareness and like a deeper understanding of things. And I feel like a really beautiful example of that is the children, you know, digging in the garden and making friends with the worms and, you know, piling up the worms and letting them have a little worm party and everything. And then, you know, later on in the day when we walk past the chickens, watching the chickens scratch around and eating worms. And somehow for the children, that's never tragic. But, you know, in a linear world, that might be like, wait a minute, but those were our friends back there, and now they're being eaten. But they know, because they also work with, you know, like the chickens, and they see that the chickens contribute to the garden, and then they're harvesting food. And so they're seeing things in a cyclical fashion, and it's being imprinted on them in such a foundational way that it's really helping to formulate how they think and how they look at the world.
I can look at my own life and see those first lessons as I sat in a classroom in kindergarten, first grade, the number line that sat on the wall, and then how that was related to the clock, and that progress that just, even though the clock has this round face, it's this progression forward, ever forward, ever forward, without necessarily having a recognition of the way that we go from winter to spring to summer to fall back to winter again, because it's not necessarily following a natural pattern. It's you're in kindergarten, now you're in first grade, second grade, third grade.
Right. And the way that the educational system is set up is that children are mostly with other children their age, and, you know, and then being of the implication is that, you know, the adults know everything and that they have to impart this information and that the children have to listen to it. And so, you know, when you're really working on creating your own educational model, you can have different ages working with each other, and you really begin to realize that as an adult, you don't know everything. If you're walking through the forest and a child asks you, what is that plant, you know, and I don't know, then there's something for us to explore. See what it looks like. I wonder what I would call it. I wonder what you would call it. And then I get to go home and sort of look it up and try to figure it out and come up with a little story. And, you know, as they get older, of course, they can do that themselves. And it's really beautiful to have lots of elders around and people who can really start telling you, oh, this plant, because elders, when they talk to you, they don't just tell you an answer, they tell you a story. And so they'll say, oh, this plant reminds me of when I was a little girl and my mom used to, you know, and so I've really been witnessing that. Up at the Wilderness Awareness School, they have an elders council. And every time the elders spoke, they spoke through an anecdote or a story. And it's such a beautiful way to impart wisdom and to create incentive and initiative and excitement around the information that's coming, because they don't just hand it to you. They give you a reason to want to find out more. Puts it in context.
You have a more holistic as opposed to that discrete knowledge. Here in Pennsylvania, I encounter a lot of issues when it comes to legally building permaculture and some of the other things because of the barriers that exist here. Do you have any kinds of barriers or issues that you've had to face in order to get your school running and to offer this program? I mean, being outdoors all year long, like any insurance risks or anything like that? Or is it fairly open in Portland to do programs like yours?
Portland is awesome, and it's a really great place to get something like this off the ground, and I think it's one of the reasons why we were one of the first that were actually able to make it happen legally. So basically, I am insured. I have to write a nice big check to an insurance company every year, so that has been a little bit of a barrier, but we definitely won't let money get in the way of, you know, what we believe needs to be happening. It's funny because what happens is you don't fit into any of the boxes. And so if you wanted to get registered as an official child care, you know, with the Department of Human Services, which we don't need to because our programs are under 4 hours or under. But if we did want to be registered, their checklist of things just doesn't even apply to us. And so it's kind of a funny, it makes a lot of people scratch their head. I think it just sits so well with people that they say, okay, well, you know, sure, yeah, we found someone to insure you. And, you know, I mean, summer camps get insured. There's all kinds of ways that, you know, wilderness programs, like they're all getting insured somehow. They're probably all paying a lot of money for it. But there is a market, you know, there are people that realize that there's a market for, you know, providing insurance for programs such as these. Since we're at an urban farm in Portland, basically our farm has one of the programs of it is called Recode Oregon, and they're actually working on a state level making sustainability legal. So basically, you know, you got to start working on a lot of levels, because basically in this country and probably in other places in the world too, it's illegal to be sustainable. It was, until Recode Oregon changed the laws, it was illegal to use gray water in your garden. It's no longer now because they made it happen, and now they're working on humanure and composting toilets. And so you just, I think you have to know your area. There's going to be some places that are really conservative that it's going to be harder to make it work. But if you have, I would say, like, my advice would be have something nearby that you could, like, okay, yeah, if we need to use a bathroom, we could go in there. If we needed to go inside, we could go in there. Maybe an agreement with a neighbor or something like that, so that you can sort of start by saying, yes, and we're just going to choose not to. And sometimes you can get registered and you can be legal and have everything all buttoned up, as long as your space that you would use if you needed it passes the criteria. There's ways that you can just really sort of put a step forward and just start making it happen. And we ask all kinds of questions to all kinds of people all the time and are constantly doing research and are really, really honest with our insurance company about what we're doing, so that we make sure that it's really clear. Everyone's really clear about what we're doing, so there are no surprises one day. I would just say, you know, like, just really speak it. Really know that you're doing something that is of service to the world. Even if some people don't understand it, a lot of people really do. A lot of people understand on some level that it's important for children to be moving their bodies and have a relationship with nature. A lot of people that might not have had that experience themselves and are now adults definitely can feel somewhere in their being a lacking. And I get parents that say that to me too. Like, I'm not really an outdoors kind of person, but I think I long for that, and I really want my child to have that experience. I think no matter where you are, there's probably a little bit more support than it might seem on the surface. I mean, you have to really live it, and you have to really believe it, and you have to talk to a lot of people about it and sort of bring them into the magic so that your community feels like they're a part of what you're doing and that they're contributing as well. It can really actually make a lot happen that way. And I'm also absolutely always willing to talk to people. I have people that contact me all the time and ask for advice on how to get their programs running in different regions. I can give you my contact information through the school, and people can contact me if they have specific questions.
I'll definitely include a link to the school in the show notes for the episode so people can find you. You guys are doing a lot of valuable work.
And I really just want to be, like, really freely giving of as much support for other programs as I possibly can.
Well, the more that we get this information out there, the more all of this becomes mainstream, the easier it is for people who are in more conservative areas to do it. We can point to models and go, well, this is what they're doing and this is how they're covered. Can you find someone who will underwrite me on this level, or can we change the laws? I know a lot of times all it is a phone call to the right person. They'll go, yeah, that law in there looks kind of silly. Yeah, we'll change that. Give us 3 or 4 months to get it through all the bureaucracy and it'll be done.
It's true. And all the people that are working for these cities, like, they're great people. There are all these rules and things, and then there are these human beings behind them. And they didn't make the rules. They're just there, you know, with these old rules that have been there forever. And it's really about relationship building. And as permaculturists, we know that. It's really true. And storytelling to your community too. Tell them about what's going on. And the parents become really vocal because they love what's happening with their children, and they talk a lot. And so word of mouth is really what starts spreading it. And then Portland loves having programs and farms and demonstrations that are sort of cutting edge, I guess. It's funny because the whole world used to be living sustainably before industry and modern agriculture and all that good stuff. You know, I mean, it's really just about people really getting in touch with that part of themselves again. And you know, we all have genetics that go back to our ancestors. They're all indigenous people. All of those lineages were storytelling, land-based, place-based people. And so we all have somewhere, even if it's really deep inside of us, we have resonance with stories and earth skills and nature, because that's the only reason why we exist, is that our ancestors had relationships with nature and the natural world and were able to survive. It's really a common ground for all of us, and it's a piece that needs to be awakened in so many people, or reawakened in so many people. And it's a beautiful thing to watch that happen, and to really be a facilitator of that process is incredibly beautiful, and people will support what you're doing when they feel an awakening in themselves.
Go out there, do it, spread the word, and get people engaged in your activity.
Exactly.
One other thing that I wanted to touch on this evening is your advanced teacher training for teaching permaculture to children. Could you tell me a little bit about that program?
Sure. I found out about it through, I think, Kelda Miller or Marisha Auerbach. They are permaculture teachers out here in the Pacific Northwest, and Marisha is the teacher who I got my PDC from. And they forwarded me because they knew that I worked with children outdoors. And so there was an institute for permaculture for children down in New Mexico, run by Patty Parks Wasserman, and she was going to run a permaculture teacher training for teaching permaculture to children. It's a mouthful. And so I contacted her and I said, oh, I can't come to New Mexico, but you should come here. She did. She came up to Portland. We flew her up, and my partner, Matt Bebo, is also a permaculture teacher, so he said that he would co-teach the course with her. And then since I'm a Waldorf teacher and we held the course at our school site and started the school, and I teach outdoor education, and it just sort of emerged that we all taught this course together and just brought all of our backgrounds. Matt is a garden educator. teacher. I have a Waldorf background. And then Patty has been doing permaculture with children, food forest projects at schools and school garden classes for years and years. So basically we converged and we just really sort of take a foundational look at, you know, it's really good for people to have at least an intro to permaculture before they come. And so we sort of take people's knowledge of the ethics and the principles and zones and sectors and sort of basic things like that. And we start applying them to models as they relate to education. And then we do a lot of just embodied, you know, we sort of look at elements of a curriculum design, and which include storytelling, nature crafts, and understanding, and food forests and food gardens. And let me think what else there is. Oh, movement and activities. Basically, all of these things also link up with the different types of intelligences. Then we really go into each one experientially. And so we do storytelling workshops. We do a lot of movement and games. We do skills and crafts, sort of how to make all your own classroom supplies. We do food forestry for children and schools, an introduction to school gardens and gardens and schools all over the country and how different places are doing it, and community building, just lots of exercises. I mean, it definitely has a flavor of a PDC, but it's much more focused and it's very fun. We bring in sort of like the childlike fun and passion of playing and learning by doing and seeing and crafting and storytelling and things like that. It's an embodied experience. And yeah, we look at different concepts and, you know, how on different levels, some older children, you're definitely going to be working with the principles and doing projects based on those principles. And then with younger children, you're going to be doing more of an embodied experience, and then just embedded in your design and how you're teaching your classes and creating your curriculum, how you can do all of that design permaculturally as well. And then we also look at permaculture in public schools, and we bring in guest teachers to do a lot of this stuff as well, and just sort of looking at like state standards and how teaching permaculture can meet up with state standards and curriculum design and things like that. So that's sort of a small overview of what the week is. It's a 6-day. And then we also, so on our very last day, we host children on site. We call it sort of a Skillshare for children. And so all of the students create a project based on what they learned throughout the week and then present it to children. And then we give feedback to each other on that after the children go. And it's a really fun way to bring it into action.
Do you plan to be doing more of these trainings in the future? Would you bring Patty back in, or would you and Matt facilitate it?
Patty, Matt, and I are planning on traveling with the course next year, and we would love to be doing it in Portland every year. We are really close to having some dates set on the Big Island in Hawaii next summer, and I'm working with some folks out in New York who are interested in hosting us, and Patty is arranging a course down in New Mexico as well. So, and we're open, you know, I mean, basically, if someone wants to host us, we just need that host on the other end that, of course, could take the course, but, you know, would really need to be able to facilitate the site and accommodate about between 20 and 30 participants who would need lodging and things like that. So we are totally open and really excited to start bringing the course to people instead of having everyone traveling to us. So hopefully there will be a course near you sometime soon. And we'd love to talk to people who would be excited to work with us on that.
I know there's a lot of work in my area that's going towards teaching children about urban agriculture and gardening, and that our first PDC for at-risk youth is being held in August.
Oh, beautiful.
A program like this could be very useful for many of the adults who are going through.
Good to know. Good to know. It's so exciting. I mean, the people that come to a course like that are just these incredibly activated, really inspiring people. And so just sharing time and space and resource with others is an incredible experience. It's just such an honor to work with so many amazing people.
No, that's good. I'm glad to know that there's more of this work going on out there and that I can share it with the world.
Thanks so much.
Well, and I think about the impact, though, that this can have to teach this curriculum at such a young age. I mean, as a parent teaching it to my small children and then looking to continue that whatever their actual educational path is. My wife and I haven't planned out yet, but we still intend, regardless of where that goes, to be supplementing with our at-home work, with my wife's love of literature and geography and her sense of place and working with permaculture and my design and teaching my son and daughter colors because of blue